How many of you have ever been to a baseball game of any kind? Okay. I think of all the major sports, that's probably my favorite one to see in person. I haven't been to, Globe Life Park or whatever they call it now. I've only been there a few times over in Arlington, but the times that I've been there, you drive up and you see it from a distance, beautiful. There's something about having your ticket in your hand. You walk in the gate. You take the escalator way up to the nosebleed seats that you can actually afford, and you find your spot. And as you look out over the field, you see it all. The green grass, the dirt that's just been watered, they've leveled out, and the smells, the hot dogs, the nachos. Maybe you feel the peanuts crackling under your feet from the previous night. It's glorious. There's nothing quite like it. And as you join in with 45,000 people cheering on your team, oh, it's a sight to behold. But you know what I always find interesting? And you notice it especially if you watch a game on TV, because that camera angle as they show the pitcher and the batter, you can see the people sitting behind home plate. I mean, these are the premium seats. You are right up close to the action. You can practically smell the catcher. You're right there. You can't ask for a better seat. But what do you so often see on those shots of the people right there? They're on their cell phones. Do you know how much they paid for those seats, by the way? A lot of money. They've got all that action right in front of them. And they're content to sit on their cell phone that they could do in their living room. It's unbelievable. They have a chance to take in the beauty of baseball up close and personal, and they are willing to settle for something that is so much less. What a tragedy. And yet, that's so often what we do in our relationship with God. Really? Well, think about it. We have access to a God that is so much grander than we could ever imagine, but we are so often content to settle for a view of Him that is so much less than it could be. It's almost like we're a child at the Grand Canyon who is staring at a rock, content to view that is the greatest that it could be when all that is out there is before Him. We may find ourselves satisfied with what we know of God, and yet there may be so much more that we're missing out on. Through our text for this morning, we're going to encounter a picture of God that will stretch how we think of Him, that will challenge us to expand our view of Him and His relationship to His people. And really, there is but one goal for us this morning, that we would better marvel at the lasting, loving kindness of our God. If you want to grab your Bible, we'll be continuing our journey through 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel, we are in chapter 9 this morning. 2 Samuel, chapter 9. And here we're going to learn of a king who showed some remarkable, and some might even say unbelievable, loving kindness to someone who seemed wholly undeserving of it. And as we examine this king's actions, we're going to find that as wonderful as they are but a small glimpse of a much greater, a much more lasting loving kindness that is actually available to all of God's people. That king is David. And as we begin reading in 2 Samuel chapter 9, we'll see that through him, God's loving kindness is put on display for all to see. Look at verses 1 through 5. And David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba. And they called him to David. And the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "I am your servant." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him?" Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet." The king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "He is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar." Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo Debar. Now, if you just pick up the story and you start from scratch, it seems like a pretty random request from David, right? But we know that it's not, based on the time that we have spent thus far going through 1 and 2 Samuel. If you remember back to 1 Samuel chapter 20, you've got David narrowly escaping an attempt on his life from Saul. Understandably, David's upset. He's distraught. He enlists the help of Jonathan, Saul's son, to help keep him safe from his father's rage. Now, Jonathan agrees to help David, and in return, he asks that David show kindness to his family from that time forward. I want to read that to you. It's in 1 Samuel 20, verses 14 and 15, where Jonathan says to David, "But show me unfailing kindness like the Lord's kindness as long as I live, so that I may not be killed, and do not ever cut off your kindness from my family. Not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth." That phrase we see in both places, 1 Samuel 20 and then also here in 2 Samuel 9, that word kindness. It's from a Hebrew word that shows up over 200 times in the Old Testament. And you're going to find it translated as everything from loyalty to steadfast love. And that's because you've got several different kinds of nuances wrapped up in that one word. And most commonly, it's used to refer to God's persistent, covenant-keeping, loving kindness to his people. And it's that type of loving kindness that David has promised to show to Jonathan's family. Now to us, we think, okay, that's a pretty normal thing to do. David seems like a nice guy. Sure, why not show kindness to somebody from Jonathan's family? But think about it. First of all, whose name does David reference at the very beginning of his question in verse 1? Saul. Now, hold on a second. Saul? The guy who tried to kill him multiple times? Yeah, that guy. Everybody would have understood if David had just simply let this promise go. I mean, after all, it's likely that only he and Jonathan even knew about it to begin with. But he follows through, despite everything that Saul had done to him. And why? For Jonathan's sake. He had made a solemn promise, and he had every intention of fulfilling it. But there's something else that's pretty unusual here about David's actions. Think about all that's just happened to him so far just in 2 Samuel. He starts off, he comes to a portion of the throne over just a portion of the kingdom. It takes him 7 years to finally get power over the entire nation. The memory of the previous king is maybe starting to fade a little bit. David is finally free to establish his mark on the kingdom. So in that situation, who in their right mind is going to seek out the family member of a previous rival king and try to show them kindness? Who does that? I mean, at the very least, we could expect that David would just leave him alone. Okay, he doesn't have to treat him poorly, but maybe he just ignored him. Just let him be and he can continue to live his life and everything will go on. But no, he doesn't do that. He also doesn't do what the culture probably would have expected, would have been just fine with. And you know what that is? Just slaughter them all. You can't have any people hanging around from previous regimes. Somebody who could be a threat to your rule, who could gather some people and try to overtake the throne. You don't play nice with those people. you get rid of them. But David does the exact opposite. Not only is he not going to kill him, he's actually going to show him the kind of loving kindness that Mephibosheth could have never imagined in his wildest dreams. And we see that as you continue on in verses 6 through 8. And I just want us to picture this scene here. As you have this crippled man walking through the doors into the court of the king, he's perhaps walking slowly, perhaps limping his way along, likely trembling with fear, because he guesses what he might think is coming next. And you can see him very awkwardly, almost humiliatingly, bowing himself down before the king, his eyes glued to the ground, awaiting his fate. And the words that he hears next would never in a million years have crossed his mind. Look, verses 7 and 8. And David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." Now, unless we think maybe David is just paying some kind of lip service here, he's going to say something nice to him, but in reality, what happens is going to be far less. We keep reading, and we see that he actually does go above and beyond in keeping his promise to Jonathan. 9 through 13, then the king called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "All that belonged to Saul and to his house I have given to your master's grandson. And you and your sons and your servants shall till the land for him and shall bring in the produce that your master's grandson may have bread to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's grandson, shall always eat at my table." And we see the kind of property that we're talking about here. This is not some little shack that Mephibosheth is going to be granted. Then Ziba said to the king, back up just a little bit. Now, Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. That's the number of people who are going to work this thing. And Ziba said to the king, "According to all that my lord, the king commands his servant, so will your servant do." So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who lived in Ziba's house became Mephibosheth's servants. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. The reversal of fortunes here is the stuff of Hollywood. Because you've got not 5 minutes before Mephibosheth walks through that door, he is defined primarily by his physical handicap, right? As a crippled man in that culture, he would have been counted among the lower of the social class. In all likelihood, you've probably got a guy who's fairly destitute, trying to make it through, trying to mind his own business, trying not to draw the wrong kind of attention to himself from the king. And now all of a sudden he sees himself ushered into a whole new world. He has the rights of the vast resources that Saul had, which means he not only has access to the property, but also the profits from what comes from the land. So he's set financially. But he's also set socially, even despite his physical condition. He has an open invitation to the table of the king, a mark of incredible honor. Essentially, he's been granted inclusion into the king's social circle. Now, can you imagine going from a mere commoner just trying to get by to all of that? It's a gesture of loving kindness from the king that has no precedent. David had set out to show loving kindness to a descendant of Saul, and he certainly did not disappoint. Now, we read this, and we're tempted to focus all of our attention on David, and that is understandable. I mean, he's a powerful king. We know of him. We like him a lot. He had no earthly reason, really, to show loving kindness to Mephibosheth. And yet he still goes above and beyond to show him generosity. It's a wonderful story. But it seems like there's more to this incident than simply an opportunity to praise David. I mean, after all, I've got to imagine that there were tons of other times that he had shown generosity to others. Surely this couldn't be the only time in his reign. So what's so special about this instance? Why does the narrator include this particular instance at this place in the book? I think the key is found in the chapter that we've just spent the last 2 weeks pondering. And that's chapter 7. If you'll recall, that's where God had promised that he was going to establish an eternal kingdom from the descendants of David. That he was going to forever rule his people through David's line. Listen again to how God says he's going to go about this. This is back in chapter 7, 2 Samuel 7, 12 through 16. Talking to David, "When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men." Wait for it. "But the steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever." Did you see it there? I mean, if you're just reading through it, you can almost blink and miss it. What will characterize this rule of God through the descendants of David? It was in verse 15. "But my steadfast love will not depart from him." Do you want to take a wild guess which Hebrew word that is? It's the same loving kindness that David showed to Mephibosheth. Is that a coincidence? I doubt it. You see, God had promised that his steadfast love, his loving kindness, would never leave his chosen king. That he would always remain faithful to this promise, that through a descendant of David, he would rule his people with a lasting loving kindness. That no matter what happened, no matter how far his people strayed from him, he would never take away this loving kindness from his king or from his people. And what did we see vividly in our text for this morning, just two chapters later? This loving kindness of God is already being demonstrated through the rule of his king, David. And yet, as incredible as this earthly king's actions were, can we even imagine how much greater is this loving kindness that God now offers to his people through his King of Kings, his Son? As only the Lord could work it out, last week I was given a little bit of a glimpse of what this loving kindness must be. And to be honest, I'm still somewhat trying to process it. Some of you know that last weekend I was with my mom and my stepdad up at the Ohio State University Medical Center. And for what was, other than her initial diagnosis, probably the most critical appointment that mom has had for her cancer since she was diagnosed nearly 2 years ago. We were there because her body had stopped responding to the chemotherapy treatment that she was on, and her local doctor wasn't quite sure what to do next, and so he referred her to the specialist there in Columbus. And so as we're sitting in the room waiting for the staff to come in, of course, we have a million thoughts going through our mind. Not the least of which is the possibility that what we hear is, "I'm sorry, there's nothing else we can do." As I sat there, I started anticipating what this visit might be like. Probably a typical hospital visit. And you know, the staff are cordial, they're nice, but they're busy. They've got tons of patients that they need to get to. They'll answer our questions, they'll be nice to us, but they're going to efficiently give us the information we need in a timely manner, and they'll be out the door on to the next patient, and then we're off their mind. That's what I expected. What I found couldn't be further from that expectation. All of the staff treated us with such care and kindness. They listened as we asked our questions, offered Kleenexes for the tears, and sat there, eyes locked on us, like they had nothing else in the world they needed to do. There was one particular of the doctors who left a profound impact on me. And I didn't know why at the time. But as he sat there with no notes whatsoever, recounting all of my mom's medical history, her diagnoses, the treatments that doctors had tried, going all the way back to the 90s, I thought, what care from this man who does not know my mother, who does not know us, and who may never even see us again. What kind of care is this that he has shown to us? It stuck with me for a few days. And I didn't quite get the significance of it until I started studying this text, and then it hit me. I couldn't remember the last time someone had shown that kind of intense loving kindness towards someone they barely even knew. And if I think that doctor showed us loving kindness in such a way, how much more must be this loving kindness of our God, who created us, who intimately knows us, and who has infinite resources at his disposal to bring it about in our lives and display it to us. It's a loving kindness that causes the sun to shine on us, that causes the rain to fall, that breathes air into our lungs, pulses blood through our veins, that provides us a million medications that sustain our lives and ease our pain, and we could go on all day. Let us not lose sight of this, that every blessing in this life we owe to the loving kindness of our God. And the best part, there's more. It's not going anywhere. You see, this loving kindness of the Lord is lasting. And how do we know? Time and again, we see that promise echoed through the pages of this book. That God will never remove his steadfast love from his people. Now, let's be clear. It doesn't mean he won't discipline us as children. Not what I'm talking about. But we can be absolutely certain that through all of that, his loving kindness will remain for his people. So friends, if we have a view of God that says, well, I need to earn his love to keep it. If we have a view of this loving kindness that says, well, that's nice, but surely that doesn't apply to me after all that I've done and the ways that I have failed. if those are our view of God's loving kindness, we are that person sitting behind home plate texting on our phone while the glory of the game is going on in front of us. Because we have settled for a picture of God that is so far below who he really is. So friends, whatever we may presently think of God's loving kindness toward us, may we go forth from here marveling at this life-changing, this abundant, this never-giving-up loving kindness that we have seen pictured in our text this morning, and that indeed oozes through all of Scripture. And as we do that, may we echo the psalmist's response to this loving kindness. Because your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you.